so that's how one got into the addition of CH2 to benzene to make it. Finally into the insertion reaction into the carbon-hydrogen bond and so forth and so on. So, in effect, working in one area and wanting a much simpler synthesis, if you will, a method of preparation, provided a lot of the stimulus, some of the other things.
Do you have much interaction with Michael Dewar at this point?
Well, Michael, I met Michael for the first time in 1956, I guess it was, in London, but by, had long before that had acquired a tremendous admiration for his originality and creativity. I mean, after all, the contribution which he made to the mechanism of the benzidine rearrangement, a completely new idea that that no one had any idea that two pieces could hang together and slip over each other and to break a bond but not fall into two pieces and then come back together again to give the cemidine rearrangement, the benzidine rearrangement, and so forth and so on. And all of those things I knew from the literature, and of course it was Michael who suggested the tropolone structure for stipatic acid and colchicine. And as a brash young man in England was, of course, being treated really quite badly by the old establishment. And so when we met for the first time, we hit it off, and we've been lifelong friends. I think he's enthusiastic about my contributions, and I know I'm enthusiastic about his.
Yes, I talked to him in February in Florida.
Did you?
Yes.
Did you?
4 hours on tape with him.
Oh, for goodness sake.
It was an enjoyable time.
I should think so. Provided he didn't spend all his time talking about his last 2 years at Texas.
No, some of it, but not all of it.
And he was still pretty exercised.
Well, I'm... Oh, by the way, I had a... This is just an aside, but I had a phone call. I talked to my research mentor from NYU this morning, who's now at Northeastern, and he said to send his regards. His name is Carl Weiss.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
He had stumbled across another way of tropylene bromide.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
He said, what did he tell me this morning? He said they had this terrible mess that they couldn't do anything with, and then he finally realized what it might be.
Yeah.
But they used what? Diazo? They used the ester.
I think they used the ester.
And benzene.
Yeah.
That was shortly after I left. I finished up my work with him. Well, how was this whole area received? I mean, it was really quite, in many respects, a breakthrough. And how was it received by the chemical
community? I would say almost immediately and with great enthusiasm. And I think much of it had to do, came from Woodward, because whenever one of these new things came out, he received it with tremendous pleasure and enthusiasm, and would give his seminar here. Well, gosh, I mean, when anything was discussed in Woodward's seminar in Cambridge, it was over all around the rest of the world in no time at all. So
Did you discuss any of these ideas with Woodward?
No.
Oh,
okay. No. No.
May I ask if there was any reason why, or is it just a matter of circumstance?
Well, we were geographically separated. Our paths crossed very infrequently, and when they did, we talked about each other's work. But it was just very infrequent. That is, he was moving in another part of the world, and I wasn't moving so much anyway.
It's not clear. Well, I guess that the carbine work was done at Hickrow, but was when you were already at Yale. Is that true? It wasn't clear when the time sequence.
Well, I think the beginning of the carbine work. I'm not so clear on the time sequence either. But the Tropolone comes out when? In 1951. 51, and so we were already working on the reaction of diazomethane and benzene before that, as I remember, 49, 50, and just as soon as we set tropolone as a goal, and from then on really began stayed with it. The insertion reaction, we got into quite independently, but of course it turned out once the war was over and you got really did your homework and got back to the literature, which wasn't being abstracted well at all, that Mirvine had been looking at the reaction of the photochemical decomposition of diazomethane in diethyl ether and had isolated normal propyl and isopropyl ether. There was confusion, a confusion exacerbated by Weisken, that reaction might have been going through an illid, or where the CH2 was attacking the oxygen to give CH2 minus O plus, and then there was a rearrangement. And such rearrangements have subsequently been found, but the clean demonstration of the insertion reaction was in the hydrocarbon. And we did that deliberately, because when you irradiate diazomethane and benzene, you get two products, terbilidine and toluene. I mean, later it turned out that there's a higher temperature rearrangement of tropylamine to toluene, but it has nothing to do with the insertion reaction. So that there is a, and then Prinzbach, Horst Prinzbach, who's at Freiburg, did some work on, which he tried to show that the insertion reaction, at least into a carbon-chlorine bond, didn't involve the separation into species. So the carbene work, if you will, or area, begins really in 49 or 50, and then it's just sort of carried on as one can see one's way to carry it on. For example, that insertion reaction, when we first did it, using pentane, isopentane, I guess, and cyclohexane as the substrates, was very difficult to analyze quantitatively. And I remember we built up, gas chromatography was just coming along, and for $50 we bought a detector from Gaumac, and put the whole thing together for a little under $100.
Amazing. You coined the name carbine. is that correct? At least
well, with the help of Bob and Woodward and Winston Shaw, the three of us were together one evening, and I was explaining how interesting these reactions were, and that it looked now as if divalent carbon was really involved. The history of divalent carbon, by the way, is very spotty, because back around at the turn of the century, Stieglitz and Neff were very enthusiastic about divalent carbon as an intermediate in a wide variety of reactions where it played no role whatsoever. I think they did imagine that it was playing a role in the Reimer-Thiemann reaction, the chloroform-phenol reaction, and that turned out to be more or less correct. But as far as aldol condensations involving carbene is concerned, it just wasn't in the cards. But they were explaining everything, and so it was discredited. And yet it's the oldest mechanistic hypothesis, I think, that one can find in the literature, going back to 1862. The person, Goitier or somebody was working, who had been working on the alkaline hydrolysis of chloroform from which you get carbon monoxide as one of the products. And the question is how. And so he threw in a mole of lassoes and pulled out HCl and had CCl2 left, right? Which was then hydrolyzed to carbon monoxide. So it's an old idea of divalent carbon, but I think it was stimulated by the few things that we did in it to become a respectable part of organic chemistry. And once respectable, it went on to develop, I guess, to a fairly high degree. But it has that funny history of going through a long period of being completely discredited. But anyway, so we were talking about it, and I said, now you've got to give it a name. And so we talked about various possibilities and finally decided this one was pretty good.
What were some of the other possibilities, do you remember?
I don't remember.
Which of the three of you suggested it originally?
And I don't think anybody knows whether.
I'm just curious. I didn't want to push that too far, but.
Well, I think we'd all had so much to drink that our memories wouldn't have been trustworthy in any of them.
You, doing all of this period of intense activity, you still were not terribly happy at Columbia. And when you moved to Yale, had you been out searching for other positions, or did they
come to
you?
No, they came to me. Yeah. I'd had an offer from Wisconsin a year or two before that, and which I turned down. And the my personal family life was really in bad shape. I was divorced in 54 with three very small children, and really a heartbreaking decision to make. It was just such a distressing, painful, exhausting relation that you make the decisions which you can never. You can't evaluate because you have no control of any sort, but it did seem to me that I couldn't go on that way, not sleeping nights and just incessant difficulties. And it had a bad effect. I mean, there were lots of work at that time that never got published just because there was a limit to the amount of energy and time and so forth.
I could identify with that.
Whatever, however you want to describe it. And So it's, with the Wisconsin offer was out of the question as far as I was concerned, because it would have taken me too far away from the children. And when I was divorced, thereafter I had the children every third weekend, and then for 6 weeks each summer. And, but Yale was possible. Still, it was a long drive picking them up from New Haven to Leonia, New Jersey. The George Washington Bridge for me is an unhappy symbol.
I have a similar feeling about the Tappan Zee Bridge, but I won't tell you why. But
all right.
It's very similar.
Anyway.
So I understand. What was the Yale department like when you got there?
Well, it was pretty well broken down. And when was it? 1950, that Jack Kirkwood was brought in by Griswold with full power to hire, maybe not to fire tenured persons, but really full power to try to make it one of the first class, say, among the top 20 or whatever, departments. But it had its, who was there when I arrived? Hill.
Arthur Hill.
Arthur, yeah. Oh. Me there? Yeah.
Because when I went to teach in 59, the chairman of the department, who was close to retirement, was a student of Hill's at Yale.
Really?
That's how I knew the name.
He was still there. And Marston Taylor, Bogart, was he there?
I don't know.
Or was he Columbia?
I think he was at Columbia.
He's Columbia, that's right. Bergman was there. It was a very, very fine, wonderful gentleman who worked in steroid. And I had interviewed him back in 1942 or 43, something like that, with the possibility of going to Yale to work with him. And but I didn't find it stimulating at that time, and it was a pretty dull place. And who else was there? Jim English, who was also a very fine person, but not a terribly active. Howard Zimmerman got his degree with Jim at Yale, and then Cassidy was there, and the organic life was pretty low.
Didn't Cassidy and English have a textbook?
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
English and Cassidy.
English and Cassidy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that was the order. But anyway, Kirkwood, was responsible for my coming. And then Ansager was there. And the physical chemistry was therefore very strong. Julian Sturtevant wasn't as yet in biochemistry. And the other physical chemists were just the satellites revolving around Ansager. Fuas.
Oh, yes. Fuas.
And old Harnard. These were all solution chemists, physical chemists, who were getting their theoretical inspiration from Ansager. But the two stimulating people there were Ansager and Kirkwood. And among physical chemists, Kirkwood certainly was a giant in terms of the breadth of his competence. There was no part of physical chemistry with which he didn't feel comfortable. He was the only physical chemist I've ever met, parenthetically, who was enthusiastic about the cumulative examination system. He thought physical chemists ought to be able, you know something about all of physical chemistry. He's the only one. And on Sartre. They were very happy with it, but all the others are so specialized that they really didn't like. And it's never worked for the physical chemists, except at, in my experience, except at Yale. But it was Kirkwood and Ansager who told me just not to worry very much more about mechanism of reactions in solution. And that it was too complicated, that there weren't ways of studying it. We were having enough trouble just finding out what sodium chloride did in water without worrying about the SN1 reaction. And when they heard that I was, you know, doing work in the gas phase, no mechanism reaction phase, said, well, that's where you should keep going. Which was very odd.
Did you get to teach undergraduate organic since you weren't able to do that at Columbia?
Oh, well, at Columbia they finally let me teach.
Oh, they did?
Oh, sure. Okay. So that all worked out. Carpenter's influence declined pretty rapidly. Yeah, but teaching undergraduates, the elementary organic has always been given me tremendous pleasure and satisfaction. And I made a habit of really not keeping lecture notes, you know, trying to rethink parts of the course at least every year. What could you do about, what should you be doing about bringing in mechanism? And, so it was, and it was a tremendously, you know, it had tremendous impact on my research. I've never worked on a problem without wondering whether, if it worked out successfully, it would be of sufficient importance that it would, you know, find its way into the beginning chemistry. And it seemed to me, you know, that carbenes would, if it worked out. I always got great, great pleasure from those things that got into the elementary books.
You had, I noticed that some of your papers were done by students who had postdoctoral support from Hickrell, but were up. It wasn't clear whether they were working at Hickrell or whether they were at Yale. Up there.
When the laboratory began to close down, the children were very good about giving some support.
Okay.
To me for postdocs at Yale. And even when I moved here, Frank Weil and his two sisters made a good donation to Harvard for the support of organic chemistry, for the support of my organic chemistry as long as I would be active, and then for the support of organic chemistry. So that relation has continued at a much reduced level, obviously. Nevertheless, a very important point.
What were the facilities like at Yale? Stirling Labs was open in 26 or 27, somewhere in there. So you were 30 years later. Were they still pretty well supported?
They were well supported once Kirkwood arrived, so that there really was no problem. I mean, Kirkwood was able to see long before any of the organic chemists, for example, that NMR would revolutionize structure determination. I can remember him coming back from a meeting of the Physical Society and sitting down with me and telling me it was going to revolutionize things, and why and how and so on. So that there really was no problem with that. And also at Yale was Dick Wolfgang, who was a radio chemist, extraordinarily brilliant man, and a person who valued originality in the I would say more highly than 90% of the physical chemists I've known. And so he had wonderful radio techniques going. He was the first person to couple GC with radioactive counting. And so you could work with quantities so small that you couldn't see the blip on the GC, but it would come out on the counter end of things. And it was he who got me interested in chemical dynamics and RRKM theory and the whole problem of how energy is used within a molecule to finally degenerate the reaction, the transition state, and so forth. I should have learned all of that stuff much earlier and from other persons, but Dick Wolfgang was an enormous stimulus to me. And it's really been true all my life. I mean, at Columbia, George Kimball, Ralph Halford, and Charlie Beckman, who was a minor figure, I found really very, very stimulating, and Joseph Mayer. Mm. And stimulating in the sense that they change your way of phrasing questions. So you just don't keep phrasing them in the same old way. And then at Yale, Kirkwood and Wolfgang certainly.
Well, you mentioned Ansager earlier.
Well, Lars was, yeah.